Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Thursday morning. It's the show on 91.5 KJZZ in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, we'll hear from Supervisor Bill Gates and reporter Adrian Fontes on changes to Maricopa County elections, and we'll hear about Northern Arizona's impact on the early days of the U.S. space program.
But first, the U.S. Border Patrol has recently come under fire for holding children in subpar conditions and for the revelation of racist social media posts. But it's rare to hear an inside account of agents' work and why they continue to do it. One agent did speak up, though. The unnamed agent spoke with ProPublica's Ginger Thompson about what it's like to do his job today and how disturbing conditions were allowed to become the norm. Thompson joins me to talk more about her conversations with the agent. And Ginger, why did he decide to speak out?
I think because the agent was feeling a bit confused, maybe conflicted about his experiences in McAllen. And I think that feeling began mostly in the later weeks of his time there. And I caught him probably in the middle of those feelings and of an attempt to try to sort them out. And when I reached him, he had even written down some of his feelings in a bit of a journal entry. And so I honestly think I just happened to catch him at the right time.
When you talk about being conflicted, it was interesting because as you write about, he talked about relating his own family to what he was seeing at this facility in McAllen.
Well, I can't say he related his own family, but certainly his own family flashed through his mind during his time there. You know, his own child flashed through his mind, and I'm not sure. There was a time, an experience that he told me about when he first got there, and he saw all these small children in the facility, in kind of a caged area in the facility. They were all sitting on the ground, and they weren't doing anything. Their eyes were sort of blank. Their faces were blank. And he sort of thought to himself, he said, you know, my kid would have been running laps around this place because he's just, at two, they're bundles of energy. And these children who were his children, who were his child's age, were just listless. And that really struck him.
There's been so much talk about the conditions of these facilities. And one of the more interesting comparisons, I think, that he made and you made in the piece was whether or not, like, what to compare these facilities to. We've obviously heard talk of them being like concentration camps, and he kind of rejected that analysis. I'm interested in what specifically he described these to.
Well, so in his conversation with me, I raised the term concentration camp and said, you know, there's some political leaders who compare these facilities to concentration camps. And he sort of stopped, and as he did through most of our conversations, he stopped to think a second, and he began to think out loud, and he's like, well, I'm not sure I think that's right. He goes, you know, maybe gulag, but that feels a little too strong. And then he goes, jail, that doesn't quite seem to cover it all. And so we came up with this kind of military comparison where he described how in the military, you know, in interrogations, there's an attempt to get people to talk and they use sleep deprivation. And then the next military guys come into the facility and sleep deprivation becomes kind of normal, so they ramp things up a little. And the next guys ramp things up a little more until you finally have kind of a full-blown torture situation going on. And what he was saying to me was that at some point, certain kinds of conditions became normal. and then they got worse and became normal, and then they got worse and became normal. And he said, suddenly the conditions in these facilities felt normal to people, even to the people, he said, who could fix things.
Did he have any expectation that by speaking out, that might change something?
I don't think so, no. I don't think that was why he spoke out at all. I think he spoke out because he felt that there was a different reality that needed to be aired, a reality that was different than the one that he was hearing either from the conservatives or progressives on this issue.
What did he make of the political dialogue about this issue, especially relative to, as he described to you, what he sees on a daily basis and the conditions in which he's working and in which these kids are living?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I spoke to him on the weekend that the vice president had visited McAllen, and the vice president, the vice president's visit followed a visit by a team of lawyers and doctors who had gone into these facilities and who were so appalled by what they saw. They spoke out publicly about these conditions, and the vice president went in there last weekend, and the vice president said that what he saw made clear that the attorney's assertions were unsubstantiated. And so I asked the agent, well, is that right? Were the lawyer's assertions about these facilities unsubstantiated? And what he said to me was, they're more substantiated than not.
During your conversations, he talked about sort of walling himself off emotionally from, you know, sort of compartmentalizing his work versus not work. I'm wondering how he described the effect that might be having on him and whether or not he's really able to not take home with him what he sees at his job.
You know, it's hard for me to tell. I will tell you what he told me. The things that he told me kind of were mixed on that. I mean, there were things in the journal entry that I thought were quite amazing, how he'd have this experience at the facility and he'd describe it as sort of a zombie wasteland kind of experience, a really jarring emotional description. And then he'd leave and he'd just sort of, he wrote about his gym routine and he wrote about grocery shopping and he wrote about these very mundane things. So it was clear to me he had some ability to compartmentalize, and I think, you know, he sort of described that as the only way to make this work, the only way he could do this. And even at one point he said something that was really disturbing to me, and I think disturbing to him when he heard himself say it, and that is that, you know, at some point you have to stop caring. At the same time, now that he's home and with his kids, and he says that, you know, going to the playground with his kid, it's hard for him to enjoy it.
All right. That is Ginger Thompson, a reporter with ProPublica. Ginger, thank you. It's nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Arizona Public Service has been making headlines this summer for a policy related to shutting off power to customers who've been late in paying their bills. That led to a change implemented by the Corporation Commission, which regulates the utility. And members of the commission want to hear from the head of APS, Don Brandt, though he hasn't replied positively to those requests. And then yesterday came word that APS is making significant changes to its messaging team. Vice President of Communications John Hatfield is moving on, and Jessica Pacheco is being elevated to Vice President of External Affairs. With us to talk about those moves is Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Mirror. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So what do you make of this initially? And give us some background on Jessica Pacheco, because there has been certainly word that she was pretty influential in the APS decision to get more involved in political campaigns.
Oh, certainly. I think her name is extremely closely associated with that decision, that this kind of increased political activity we started seeing kind of in 2012, but especially in the 2013, 2014, that election cycle. Her name is just kind of inextricably linked to that. She's runs their lobbying and basically political operations. And, you know, in 2014, the political activity we saw was not, you know, their name wasn't on anything, but it was one of those things where everyone kind of knew where this money, this kind of anonymous dark money was coming from, but they weren't admitting it or denying it. In 2016, they spent a lot of money in Corporation Commission races, and acknowledge that. And then just this year, because of kind of a change in the makeup of the Corporation Commission, they started holding APS's feet to the fire and made them disclose, you know, years worth of political activity. And so they had to acknowledge all the money they spent in 2014 in the Corporation Commission and some other races, the money they spent in 2016. And Jessica Pacheco's name was all over that. And this was really what we saw in 2014 is really kind of a departure from the way that APS has always operated. Traditionally, they have not spent in the races for Corporation Commission, this five-person statewide elected body that regulates utilities in Arizona, most notably APS, which is, of course, the state's biggest company. And then, you know, around that time, around the time that Pacheco took over this role and kind of had her role elevated, that's when we, along with Don Brandt kind of coming in as CEO, that's when we really started to see this change in the way they approached the political scene, especially from an electoral standpoint.
Yeah, well, some may speculate then with, as I mentioned, the headlines with APS not being universally positive, let's put it that in that gentle sense, that someone who's so involved, someone who's been so involved with the political stuff is getting elevated. Does that, I mean, just in terms of the speculation, it seems as though a utility, a company would go in a different direction, let's put it that way.
If you wanted to send a message that things were changing, yeah, you could certainly go a different direction. Now, kind of the way that I read this, and I think a lot of the way a lot of folks are reading this, the way some sources I was talking to yesterday are reading this is kind of a sign of APS digging in its heels. What we're seeing right now is they're under a microscope, and you know, like never before, you're starting to see more pressure being applied by the Corporation Commission. Certainly not as much as some of the anti-APS crowd would like, but you're starting to see a lot more scrutiny, and this is kind of I think a lot of people are reading this as a sign that APS feels like they're going to not only survive this, but can kind of continue along their path. This is, like I said, really digging in their heels, taking the person who is very much the public face of some of their most controversial policies and elevating her in this way. I don't know that this really changes anything in terms of the way that APS operates, but it's certainly, you know, kind of a sudden, I think some people could interpret that as very tone deaf.
Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Mirror. Jeremy, thanks for the quick update. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks a lot.
The 2016 election cycle in Arizona saw hours-long lines outside polling stations for the spring presidential preference primary, images that were broadcast around the world and led to embarrassment, and more importantly, concerns about the fairness and efficiency of the voting process. 2018 saw improvements, but there were still some problems with polling stations not being opened in time. And the ongoing challenges of counting ballots with both efficiency and speed continued to be highlighted. Maricopa County has moved to improve the overall situation, committing millions to better technology and increases in staff. Plus, the Board of Supervisors is going to work much more closely with County Recorder Adrian Fontes. We'll hear from Fontes in a few minutes. I start with the chair of the Board of Supervisors, Bill Gates. Chairman Gates, did you and the other supervisors believe something had to be done to fix the process following the hiccups in 2016 and 2018?
Yes. Look, you're always going to have issues in an election, especially when you're talking about the fourth largest county in the country. But in 2016, as probably all your listeners recall, with the presidential primary election, we had significant issues. We had people standing in lines for hours and hours. And with all the attention that was on Arizona for that primary, that really got people looking at it and saying, what can we do to do a better job? Then fast forward to the 2018 primary election, a little different issue. But again, probably most of your listeners recall, if they showed up, you know, there were about 60 or 70 of the primary locations that they showed up at to vote, they weren't ready for business. And so those type of issues really put this at the forefront, and it reminded the supervisors that we need to do more than just rely upon the efforts of the recorder, but possibly stand up alongside the recorder to ensure that that level of issue doesn't reoccur.
Was there concern that there was some under-budgeting in terms of whether it is technology, whether it's enough staffers?
Yeah, so the efforts that the Board of Supervisors took back in June, it's really a three-legged stool. So there's organizational changes. There are also staffing changes where we'll be adding about 25 new employees. So obviously there's a dollar amount attached to that, but there's nothing more important in a democracy than the right to vote. And then finally, there's the tabulation system. Look, the Board of Supervisors has a great track record, I would say, of being fiscally conservative. Having said that, we all understood that it was time, and everyone knew this, really, that 2018 was going to be the last election cycle for this old tabulation system. Time for a new system.
So as far as personnel goes, the county recorder, in this case a he, but when Helen Purcell was there, they choose their elections director. So now one of the changes we're going to see, the supervisors are going to choose sort of their own elections director of sorts to work together?
Yeah, so the way that it's been, again, since 1955, when Maricopa County was a much smaller place, the elections director has been selected by the recorder, reported directly to the recorder. Now, under the new system that the Board of Supervisors unanimously approved in late June, we will now have a director of election day and emergency voting operations. That person will report directly to the Board of Supervisors, and then the recorder will have his, in this case, his elections director, who's responsible for early voting, which is within the recorder's responsibility, and voter registration. That person will report directly to the recorder.
Whether it's Recorder Fontas choosing his elections director or the supervisors choosing this, I think the average cynic might say, okay, I think they mean to do the right thing, but is there an expertise there? Because whenever we hear about appointees, people wonder, okay, was this person chosen because he or she got along with the supervisor or gets along with the county recorder? How can we feel confident these are people who really know their stuff?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And I can tell you, Ray Valenzuela, who's the person who reports directly to the recorder, has decades of experience in elections. And then the Board of Supervisors, we have already appointed our Election Day director. And this is a man by the name of Scott Jarrett, who has a lot of experience specifically working with the Elections Department, with the recorder. These are professionals. These are not political appointments. And I think that's a very important part of this, that your listeners understand that.
What's the process going forward now? Now that the people are in place, at least the leaders are in place for this. November 2020 in some ways seems a long time away, in other ways it doesn't. So what are some of the steps? Are there sort of progress reports you're going to be having?
Yeah, so we are working on the details of an elections operations agreement, which will make very clear to the recorder and the Board of Supervisors what the lanes are as far as who's going to have the responsibility for what. And then, you know, we're going to be getting the tabulation system online and then hiring those other individuals, filling in the whole team. Because it's not just November 2020.
I know. That August of 2022.
And not only that, but we have a presidential primary election coming up in March. So it's coming quick. We understand that. The recorder understands it. So we're laser focused on getting everything into place.
Chair of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors, Bill Gates, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
And now I turn to County Recorder Adrian Fontas to find out how the changes may affect how he carries out his duties. Adrian, what stands out to you about the changes that are being implemented and why they're being put into effect?
Well, you know, this is a culmination of several years' worth of work. I mean, I got elected to modernize and update the election systems in Maricopa County, and you really can't make significant systemic changes until you've seen what you're dealing with. And so we had to go through the entire 2018 cycle first. We had been talking about making major changes in some areas, and we decided to hold off, utilize a lot of the main parts of the system that we had through 2018. And then we said, okay, let's get together and figure out how we're going to do this. And so I had a lot of meetings with a lot of folks, particularly Chairman Gates. Bill and I have gotten together quite a few times over breakfast on weekends and cheeseburgers and milkshakes, and it's all because he and I want to make sure that we're putting together a system that's going to work.
There were some concerns during the primary season, but it seemed like many of those concerns had been alleviated, many of them by November. But do you think that some of the changes when it comes to technology, when it comes to having more hands on deck, is going to make a big difference?
Absolutely. You know, that was one of our major concerns from the beginning, from when I first took office. You know, we just looked at the place and it was understaffed. And I think it's clear evidence not only from our budget request coming into January of this year for the new budget year that we just started, and even with the staffing analysis that happened in the last several months, you know, we almost doubled the size of the election department because we needed it really, really badly. You know, since about 2000, 2002, we've more than doubled the number of voters in Maricopa County. And we, you know, that kind of increase in volume, with the changes in technology that we've got, you've got to make major adjustments sometimes. And, you know, this is the time to do it. And we've got great cooperation with the board, who still maintain, you know, a great deal of statutory responsibility, giving some of that responsibility back to them and the appointee that they put in to sort of co-direct this whole thing. You know, it's very collaborative. We're doing turnover meetings, and the conversation is constant. And it's really great to see this, a lot of county professionals working together for the good of the voters, you know, and that's, it's really neat to be a part of.
Do you still have the level of decision-making that you yourself want to have, even with additional input from the supervisors? Do you think that is, you mentioned collaborative. Will it be a good collaborative experience? I mean, will there be stepping on toes potentially, though?
I don't know that there will be any stepping. I mean, this is new, right? So, you know, my crystal ball is kind of out of batteries right now. But, you know, just let me say this very, very clearly. For a long time in Maricopa County, there's been a lot of these weird suspicions about, you know, this partisan elected position running all of elections. And that is all from voter registration through tabulation, recruiting and training folks, polling places, all the way to the canvas, everything in one person. That's not a good model. It's not good government. So even if it's me sitting here saying you should trust me, the folks out there, the general public, I think are better served, frankly, with a better model, with a good government model. And if that means that there's a little bit of this and a little bit of that that goes back to the supervisors that they should be making decisions on, well, so be it.
You're not a wallflower. You're a very confident, charismatic person. So was this initially, did it feel like politics, though, initially to you?
I mean, you know, there were some moments where I felt like there was some kind of minor weaponization of some of the little issues that had happened. Some of them were big issues. And we needed to be called out on them. But I think there's a lot of folks out there who are just looking to take political advantage out of something that ought not be taken political advantage of. And that's okay. You know, the American politics has always been hard scrabble. It's always been rough and tumble. You know, you get bloody knuckles, and that's American politics. But that's another one of the reasons why, you know, I welcomed this. You know, every time someone has said, well, we need an audit, I'm like, well, let's do an audit. You know, let's bring folks in and look at these things and talk about these things. And that's one of the reasons why we now have a new tabulation system. It's one of the reasons why we now have 26 new employees coming on board between now and hopefully before the end of the year to help with 2020. That's one of the reasons why we've got a broader scope of duties back in the hands of the supervisors, because it's important. These are all very important things to maintain and rebuild some of the trust in elections that they didn't just deteriorate when I got elected. Let's not forget, for a long time, there were folks on the other side of the aisle from the prior recorder that really weren't trusting of stuff.
Adrian Fontes is Maricopa County Recorder. Always good to see you. Thanks.
Good to see you, too. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Okay, so that is one small sound.
How many hit points does the spider have?
Quite a few, apparently.
So I'm Ronald Wright. I've been playing D&D since, like, 1984, so I've been doing this forever. Dungeons & Dragons is just a basic cooperative storytelling experience. As a dungeon master, I present challenges and watch the players overcome them.
The town of Appleton has been having trouble with the dead rising from the grave. So ultimately, what do you want to do?
You know, I just finished off this ghoul with a great axe. I'll hit it. So I roll the blessing and this D20.
Yes.
That uses up the slot. Yes.
Okay. Just like my bless.
And they can work through it any way they want to. Everything from if you have the mage who casts the spells to the warrior who just likes to hit things. You know, it's like play the character, play it the way you want, have fun doing it. I tell my new players all the time, first rule of D&D, have fun.
20.
Oh, nice.
Is that you want to take the 20.
Three or 20.
That's Ronald Wright playing Dungeons & Dragons at the Arizona Game Fair's weekly open gaming night. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, or just want to tell us about your epic adventures, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
The
This is the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Still to come, we'll hear from a couple of journalists about their new book, There's No Crying in Newsrooms, and stay with us in about 25 minutes for The Takeaway. Celebrations of Apollo 11's historic moon landing 50 years ago conjure images of Houston and Cape Canaveral, but rarely northern Arizona. Yet the region played a pivotal role in preparing astronauts for lunar missions and making sure they did some science while they were up there as well. From KJZZ's Arizona Science Desk, Nicholas Gerbus reports.
There's all sorts of old garages around town where the rovers were built, or instruments were designed, or they tested geology techniques and so on. And a lot of that's forgotten.
Lowell Observatory historian Kevin Schindler describes the indispensable roles the crags and craters of northern Arizona played in getting astronauts ready to explore the moon.
They don't know much about geology, but when they go to the moon, we want them to pick up rocks and do scientific surveys and such. So let's bring them to a place where there's a lot of comparable geology.
That included the volcanic field of Sunset Crater, the impact geology of Meteor Crater, and the geologic layers of the Grand Canyon. To more accurately replicate the lunar experience, the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff even blasted 426 craters into a cinder field.
The USGS created a man-made crater field to simulate what it would be like on the moon.
Fire!
Much of that 10-acre facsimile of the Apollo 11 landing zone still survives in cinder hills. Every astronaut who bounced across the lunar surface first clambered around Arizona's craters. Jeff Beal is head tour guide at Meteor Crater.
This was part of their routine, basically. They come here for a day, and then they go to Cinder Hills for a couple of days, and then I know they went to the Grand Canyon first and all that. So they all had the same circuit that they would train.
Jerry Schauber fondly recalls the astronauts he trained while he was with the USGS. The service built a prototype rover for the astronauts to test drive on the crater field.
They said things like, we felt right at home on the moon because of you guys, because the rover they trained in drove exactly like the one on the moon, except theirs bounced up and down a lot more because of the gravity.
Schauber also worked with astronauts from later crews, including geologist Harrison Jack Schmidt of Apollo 17, the only scientist ever to set foot on the moon, and Apollo 15 commander David Scott.
Dave Scott really liked geology, so that was a blessing, really.
The need for scientific pursuits initially eluded NASA and President Kennedy, who viewed the moon more as the finish line of a race between Cold War superpowers than a target for scientific missions.
Originally, it was really a space race, and they just wanted to get to the moon. But then they realized they need to do a little science once they get there. So that's when Shoemaker got involved with NASA.
Eugene Shoemaker, geologist, would-be lunar explorer, and later co-discoverer of the famed Shoemaker-Levy 9 comet, pushed hard to add science to the missions.
What does picking up rocks have to do with beating the Russians? But the scientific community, including Gene Shoemaker, really pushed NASA and said, you know, if we're going to go to another world, we should take advantage and explore as much as possible.
Shoemaker had a pedigree particularly suited to the job. Beyond his fascination with the moon, he had recently completed doctoral research that overturned the conventional wisdom that Meteor Crater was volcanic in origin. Tim Swindle is the director of the Lunar and Planetary Laboratory at the University of Arizona.
It was Eugene Shoemaker who really convinced the scientific world that, yes, Meteor Crater is a meteor crater. It's an impact crater and not a volcano.
That mattered because scientific consensus rejected the idea of meteor impacts on Earth and favored volcanic origins for craters here and on the moon.
Meteor Crater was important for demonstrating that impacts really do happen and giving a feel for what they look like.
Between Lowell's telescopes and the area's remarkable geology, northern Arizona gave Apollo astronauts an unequaled visual and tangible context in which to understand their distant and desolate destination.
And, you know, a lot of the stuff that was happening here with the mapping and the astronaut training is still going on in Arizona, in some of the same places where the Apollo astronauts went.
NASA's current crew of astronauts will arrive in Flagstaff for training this fall. Once again, a USGS scientist will train them. Nicholas Gerbus, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Tomorrow, we'll hear part two of this story as we explore the roles Central and Southern Arizona played in the Apollo missions.
And as we just heard, Northern Arizona played a major role in the preparation for the Apollo missions. For some more context, I'm joined by Danielle Adams. She's Deputy Director for Marketing and Communications at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. And Danielle, what to you are the biggest impacts institutions in Northern Arizona had on making the Apollo missions happen?
Well, a lot of it really focuses on astrogeology and the desire to use the Apollo missions not just to get to the moon first to beat the Russians, but to do some real science there on the moon. And so there was a flurry of training that happened here in Flagstaff and the media area, including Grand Canyon, Meteor Crater, and that was done in order to help prepare the astronauts, not only to do basic things like navigation on the moon, but also to be able to collect rock samples and really do some research that we're still studying to this day.
What specifically happened in Flagstaff that allowed the astronauts to sort of know how to do that research? I mean, it's fairly obvious, like if you walk through Meteor Crater, for people who are actually allowed to do that. Like, it makes sense, like, how that would help an astronaut figure out what the surface of the moon might look like. But what happened in terms of helping astronauts actually do the science?
So it started with Gene Shoemaker at the United States Geological Survey, the astrogeology branch here in Flagstaff. And there were a few things that occurred at different sites. So as you mentioned, Meteor Crater is the Earth's best preserved meteorite impact site. And so that gave the astronauts a great example of what it looks like and what real ejecta from the site would look like. But on the moon, they were also going to encounter a lot of smaller craters. And so one of the most spectacular things that they did was to generate a few simulated crater fields in the cinder fields just east of Flagstaff. And there they used many pounds of dynamite to blow up craters of different sizes. In some cases, they made sort of a random sample. In other cases, they nearly exactly replicated specific fields on the moon. And that was used extensively to train the astronauts how to recognize craters once they got to them.
How did it come to be that Flagstaff was a hub for all of this training? I mean, it seems like a lot of it probably could have happened in a lot of different places.
So a few factors, really mostly natural factors here in Flagstaff. So Flagstaff and the immediate area has a really diverse array of geological features. We have over 600 volcanoes in the Flagstaff area. There are resulting lava flows and cinder fields and basically features that scientists back then during the Apollo era thought that we might encounter on the moon. And so the fact that Flagstaff was surrounded by all of this volcanic geology was a great boon to be able to simulate the experiences that the astronauts might have on the moon. In addition, the great weather here in Flagstaff allowed for this kind of training to go on almost year-round. And then on the side of lunar mapping, which is where Lowell Observatory comes into play here, Flagstaff again was chosen because of the great weather and many clear nights during which they could access the moon without having clouds interfere.
You mentioned that Lowell was involved in mapping the lunar surface. What kind of work did that entail, and how important was it to the actual mission?
Well, back at that time, we didn't have very good maps of the moon. We didn't have probes orbiting the moon, so we had no idea what the far side of the moon looked like. And then also, our maps of the moon were generated from photographs, so they were pretty much photographic atlases. And so there was a real need to create highly detailed maps of the moon. They needed an instrument that they could use to map the moon and take visual observations so that they could use the perfect moments of seeing during the night to draw in the details that could not be captured with photographic film. And so after shopping around to first the U.S. Naval Observatory, who then recommended Lowell Observatory's 24-inch Clark refractor. The Aeronautical Chart and Information Center was set up at Lowell Observatory to start this program of mapping the moon.
What would you say the legacy of Northern Arizona's involvement with the Apollo missions has been since then?
Well, there are some obvious things like doing a lot of geology on the moon. And the last Apollo mission, Apollo 17, had a geologist, Jack Schmidt, who was the first non-pilot, non-Air Force astronaut to go to the moon. So there's that obvious heritage of geologic science that was happening. But then also there were other small things. For example, as the testing was done and the training was done, we realized that there was a need for taking video on the moon. And this hadn't really been thought of before. And it's very likely that without the training program here in Northern Arizona, we may not even have had that first video of Neil Armstrong walking down the ladder.
All right, that's Danielle Adams with Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. Danielle, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Newsrooms, like most other workplaces, have been dominated by men in management and other influential roles since the earliest days of journalism. That often limited opportunities for women and allowed a certain kind of action. Sometimes that involved an extra level of aggressiveness, including yelling and other temperamental behavior. To some extent, that has changed, but not entirely. After interviewing well over 100 current and former print and broadcast journalists, mostly women, Kristen Gilger and Julia Wallace wrote the recently published book, There's No Crying in Newsrooms, What Women Have Learned About What It Takes to Lead. It's full of stories about what women have accomplished, achieved, and learned in newsrooms, sometimes under trying circumstances. Gilger is Senior Associate Dean at ASU's Walter Cronkite School and the mother of our co-host, Lauren. Wallace is Frank Russell Chair at the Cronkite School. Kristen, let me start with you. The title of the book stands out. How important was that and how challenging was it to choose?
We had a hard time coming up with the title for this book, and it didn't occur to me until I remembered that my favorite movie is League of Their Own, right? And Tom Hanks says, there's no crying in baseball. And when I thought of it, we both realized that we interviewed almost 100 women for this book, and crying kind of came up a lot. Mm. Women would bring this up about, and we have ourselves as editors in newsrooms advised many women, don't cry in the newsroom. You go to the restroom if you have to cry, right? You're not showing that kind of weakness. And a lot of the women we interviewed who came up in newsrooms around the time that we did in the 80s had the same experience. That's changing some. And Julia interviewed Melissa Bell of Vox, and she had a different experience.
Right. So, you know, so we for years have said, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. You've got to be tough. And she cried 3 times when I interviewed her. And I talked to people on the staff who said, yeah, she cries sometimes. And so I talked to her about it, and she said, you know, I've come to terms with it. This is sort of part of who I am. And people have to get comfortable with it. And you know, back to your point about it's okay to yell, it should be okay to cry.
Yeah.
I think hopefully we're beginning to sort of understand that we need a workplace that is different than our current norm. Mm-hmm.
So are women supposed to yell then? I mean, is there not maybe not
some
now,
do.
but were they supposed to sort of match what men were doing in the newsroom?
I think it depends upon the era you're talking about.
Okay.
So when we interviewed women who came up in the 70s, basically, and they're really the pioneers in breaking down barriers in newsrooms, moving from features into the news divisions, for example. They were tough as nails, and they had to be, and they often adopted the sort of management styles of their male colleagues, you know, hard drinking, hard cussing, hard headed, mm-hmm. Because they had to get ahead. But we do think that's changing some, especially with younger generations, millennials coming into newsrooms who don't respond very well to that style and really want something that is, if not nurturing, at least more respectful.
So when we started the book, one of the reasons we wanted to do it is we felt these were untold stories, stories that hadn't been researched in any way. And one of the stories we found that so captivated us was the story of Aggie Underwood. She was one of the first CIT Metro editors in the country, and she kept a baseball bat on her desk and a gun in her drawer with a
loaded with blanks.
Loaded with blanks. And if you know, people gave her trouble, she'd just take the gun and shoot it into the air. I mean, yes, she was a character, but that was sort of what it took to be a woman in the early days.
What has changed generationally to whatever extent? I mean, you both have a lot of experience in newsrooms. You both still have experience dealing with young students and whatnot. And they may even be male and female, Kristen.
Yeah.
So what are we seeing there? Are we seeing a greater evolution of young men? Are we seeing the idea that they do believe that true diversity and true fairness is what is needed?
Yes. I mean, I think that there are many young men who are very attuned to the need to have a more equal kind of workplace and are very supportive of women in that context. But there are some things that haven't changed a lot. Mm-hmm. But I do think that young women in newsrooms today and those entering newsrooms are much less willing to put up with what we put up with. And again, we put up with what we put up with, and women coming up in the 70s and 80s, because otherwise they were going to lose their seat at the table. And they felt like they were really paving the way for the next generation of women. Many of them tell us they're shocked that things haven't changed more than they have. Sexual harassment is an example of that. I mean, you've seen what's happened with the Me Too movement and the revelations about many news organizations. I think that the women we talk to now, and you might want to talk about one young woman who is a student of ours in particular, are much less willing to sort of put up and shut up.
Right. Okay. So, you know, the one Kristen's talking about is there was a student of mine, Kendra Penningraf, who was an intern at the Capital Times and was sexually harassed by Representative Don Shooter. And the story goes that the Capital Times wanted to do, you know, was researching it, and nobody wanted to go on the record. And she's like, I'll go on the record. And then they called everybody else and said, we have an intern on the record. Won't you go on the record? But, you know, she was just sort of like, enough is enough. I'm done.
Do you ever get frustrated with the next generation that maybe they're not either acknowledging some of the difficulties that came before, or they're not willing to step up in quite the same way?
No.
Okay.
The opposite. So I'll tell you one anecdote, which I love. So Kristen had this experience when she was a reporter where, sorry, Kristen, I love this story.
go ahead.
Yeah, she's like, oh, don't tell this story.
She tells all her students this story.
So she's trying to get some documents from a source, and he says, I'll give them to you if you sleep with me. And she says, I don't want them that badly, and stomps off. So I said to her, well, I wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have slept with him, but I would have tried to convince him to give me the documents, et cetera, et cetera. When I tell my students that story, they actually have a different answer. Was, well, why didn't you report him?
And it never occurred to me to report him.
Mm-hmm. Neither one of them. Right.
That, I think, is indicative of a shift.
How quickly does this sort of thing evolve or change as more women are in leadership roles?
First of all, there aren't as many women leading news organizations now as there were 15 years ago.
Okay.
So in some ways, we're going backwards. Our assumption coming up was, okay, we're going to keep our seat at the table. We're going to be tough. We're going to get ahead. We're going to do what we have to do. And we're going to bring women up behind us. And once we have critical mass, everything will change. Mm-hmm. Well, that hasn't happened. Now, critical mass is important,
yeah.
Right? If for nothing else, then you have a support system and you have mentors and people who can assist you along the way. But I don't think that's the entire answer. I think that it's a larger institutional, cultural, procedure, policy change that's needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think it's really about thinking more deeply about what are the culture and policies you have in place. What is your, you know, what is your maternity leave? What is your paternity leave? Mm-hmm. You know, how are you sort of allowing working families to be in the workplace, and what does that look like? You know, how do you deal with issues when they emerge, and how aggressive are you about it, and how transparent are you about them? Mm-hmm. You know, when things happen, when there are incidents, do you, you know, acknowledge them, or do you try to hide them under the rug? And so I think until those issues really get resolved, we won't make the progress we need to.
I mean, there are things that are much better than there were when, you know, women were relegated to the feature section or had to keep a gun loaded with blanks mm-hmm. on her desk to get authority in the newsroom. We've come a long way. I don't want it to sound like, you know, we don't think there's been any progress.
Kristen Gilger and Julia Wallace are the co-authors of the new book, There's No Crying in Newsrooms, What Women Have Learned About What It Takes to Lead. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Monsoon season is officially here, and while the first storms have yet to roll into Phoenix, other parts of the state have already experienced their first monsoons. So that means it's time to celebrate this uniquely Arizona time of year. This year, for our Monsoon Stories series, we're zeroing in on the ways the monsoon season awakens our senses. First up, smell. And for that, our co-host Lauren Gilger brings out the creosote.
You can feel when a monsoon storm is coming. The air thickens, the cicadas call, the dust gathers on the horizon. And then the storms awaken our senses from how they sound, look, and feel to, yes, even how they taste. But we begin our monsoon series this year with how they smell.
When I smell creosote, I smell a freshness, almost rejuvenation. I guess I'm putting words to the emotional sensation of it, but it's always a welcome aroma.
Becky Garza would know. The former biology teacher runs La Yerbería Botanicals out of Tucson, where she creates salves and lotions from creosote resin.
You know, if you just rub your hands along the leaves, you'll smell that same aroma. And even if they don't know what plant I'm talking about, I'll let them smell it. And they're like, oh yeah, this is the rain. This is the rain.
After a monsoon storm, that smell of creosote fills the air. It's my favorite part of the season. When the rains stop, the desert opens up and smells new. But it turns out creosote is about much more than its smell.
Every people that have ever lived by it have used it as medicine.
Garza says it's antibiotic, antiviral, antifungal, and it has qualities that promote tissue healing. And that is because its desert environment has made it incredibly strong.
I think about the creosote. It's sitting out there on these sun-baked playas. There's no water. It's just getting this harsh desert environment. This is a plant under stress. So it develops a lot of mechanisms for protecting itself. This is why it has UV protective molecules. This is why, you know, it can't get up and run, so it has to develop strategies to prevent predation by bacteria, by viruses, by fungus, so animals don't browse it. And all of these things, all of these strategies, they're things we kind of bum them off of the plant.
Creosote has been used for an estimated 5,000 years in this region. It's sacred to the Tohono O'odham people. It was the first plant created in the tribe's creation story. And Garza says it's been used by many tribes in spiritual purifying rituals.
Shigoy is a name given to it by the O'odham people. In Spanish, you know, when the settlers came in, it's La Gobernadora, which means the governess. Cattle ranchers call it greasewood. Botanists came in and called it Laria tridentata. And currently, as a research focus, it's called mesoprocol.
Garza says creosote is the perfect model for the desert we live in.
So in some ways, because it's in this kind of very harsh desert climate, it has become one of the strongest plants there is.
There are reports of it, its performance after nuclear testing. It was the first plant to return after nuclear testing took place. So this plant is hardy.
Hardy, just like you have to be to live in this place.
Mark, I can almost smell it in the studio. I guess fresh is a good way to describe the smell of creosote. Anything come to mind for you?
It really is so unique to Arizona, right? I'd never smelled it until I came here. And now anytime it even remotely comes close to raining and you smell it, you know instantaneously where you are and sort of what time of year it is.
Well, now that all of you know what we think, if you have a good way to describe the smell of this mysterious plant or a story about it, don't be shy. Tell us.
Yeah, there are plenty of ways you can take part in the Monsoon series. Just go to monsoon.kjzz.org, find out how to tell us your story, or send us the best monsoon photo you've captured. Your story could end up on the air. Your photo could be featured on our website.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.